Hi, everybody, and welcome to Tapped into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with you is my friend and producer, Handsome Jason. And today's conversation topic may contain sexual material. So please, if you find this alarming, I'm sure there's a Hallmark channel with something more appropriate for you. Those of you who are willing to traverse into a subject matter that should be traversed in more frequently, today our guest is Daka Zigi, who is a psychedelic facilitator using touch and the owner of Gay Massage Vancouver. So Zigi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny that, you know, our previous conversation and a mutual friend sort of put me in contact with you. Mm. And then as I went through your webpage and we had the conversation, I realized sort of how important what you're doing really is. Mm. And so just sort of as a general consensus to familiarize our viewers, like, so what are you doing?
Yeah, so I have a multi-pronged practice. I teach yoga. I offer body work. I facilitate workshops for self-identified men to explore touch and connection. And also I guide clients in psychedelic assisted sessions. So primarily when I'm working in that context, in the latter context, it's with somebody who I have worked with somewhat, you know, a few sessions, and there's a intention on the part of the client to work with some part of either their sexual healing or working with any challenges, obstacles they have towards connection, intimacy, relaxing into touch. So that's the summary.
Well, and you know, and I think this is so important because, you know, like in our previous conversation, we exist arguably in a theocracy. You know, the ideal structure that we work with is Christian based, you know, and in Christianity, like, you know, shaming on masturbation, shaming on sexuality, you know, promiscuity is viewing as being some sort of token of evil in this sense. And I think that we've all grown up in Western society and many societies that follow theocracies to significantly suppress our sexuality. And in my understanding with psychedelic use and stuff like that is that we really internalize a very significant amount of sexual traumas, and not necessarily, you know, sexual abuse, but just traumas endured by living in a culture that shames sexuality. And so I'm curious, you know, how does what you do address that?
Well, first off is that, you know, I'm doing this work mostly with clients who are sober, and there's a lot of important work to be doing there. I certainly wouldn't recommend psychedelic work, including touch, right off the get-go, because as you said, is there's a lot of trauma there, and we don't want to just run, you know, headfirst into some traumatic space. And there's a lot that we can do through working with the kind of ordinary state of consciousness. And so then it becomes, usually what happens is then through that work, people are starting to identify specific intentions or obstacles they have around really accessing and embodying their, and it's not always sexual. It could be more about erotic, sensual pleasure. It could be more about intimacy and really, like, you know, really being present to another person while being in the erotic state. So it's, yeah, it's quite varied. But in general, I would say I agree with you that we live in a very sex negative culture. And this sex negativity, I think, has been, you know, directed towards some populations more than others, especially, you know, myself being queer, but also women and trans folks. So it's I think for me in my own personal journey, you know, this kind of sexual healing is really quite important. And what I want to say is that what's really important, especially for the population I work with, which is mostly queer and trans folks, is that because the nature of the oppression and the nature of the trauma is the demonization of one's sexuality. It's literally saying your sexual energy is dangerous, evil, unnatural, somehow like a psychological mistake, or it's just you're confused, or, you know, all the different narratives that kind of Christianity and Western science have placed upon our sexuality, is that it's the very nature of the healing has to address the sexual. It's not something that we can just talk about. You know, it's when the nature of the wound is to say your sexual energy is dirty, wrong, you know, bad, then the most healing thing is to really be in that erotic aroused state and to be witnessed in that. And by witnessed, I don't literally mean just like being watched or something, but I mean to have somebody in that space with you who's coming from a place of deep acceptance and compassion for that expression of the energy. And so,
in a sense, about being vulnerable and then having someone there to witness your vulnerability and tell you it's okay.
Which is kind of par for the course for any kind of therapeutic work, especially psychedelic assisted therapy, you know, whether you're working with PTSD or other abuse or shame or trauma. It's really, that's the most therapeutic thing, is to be vulnerable and to have that be accepted. But perhaps one of the differences between this work and those other contexts is that those other contexts primarily happen in a speaking, you know, we share stories or we share thoughts or feelings, etc. And in this work, it's more about accessing an embodied state and being in that embodied state. And that's really what makes psychedelics so useful, is because psychedelics naturally put us into a kind of, we can feel our bodies very intensely, very deeply, if we choose to focus on that, if we choose to have that intention. And so it really just, it works together really well.
You know, and I think it's something important to note is that, you know, we were expressing ourselves to one another for a lot longer than we have been verbally. You know, if you think about our evolutionary past, there's so much of conversation and communicating that occurs non-verbally. Yeah. And I completely agree with that statement that, you know, sitting and I'm not knocking talk therapy or in any way or sense or form, but you have to create an idea and turn it into a language or a word or a sentence to express it, where, you know, what you're referring to in a psychedelic state is more of a embodying that emotion entirely and being able to let it go, which I think is profoundly important. And, you know, I really, you know, even after a conversation, I've thought about this considerably and talked to my wife about it. My wife and I, we do psychedelics together and a lot of sort of sexual healing. And I find it amazing that this is something that is so overlooked in society and that it's so shamed, and there's so many hoops and concerns and stigmas surrounding this, that the fact that you're doing this as an actual practice is fantastic. However, you know, the idea of modern therapists, or, you know what I mean? Like, you know, in sort of the actual setting of an above ground practice, being able to do work on this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm not even sure if that's possible in the environment that we currently have. And I think that you exist in a niche market that it can. And here I'm going to make a disclaimer right now. I'm a heterosexual white male. I do not have the right to be empathizing with other groups or making, you know, stereotypical suggestions on how this works. So please correct me if I'm wrong on this. But like you said too, you exist in a highly marginalized community where people are being shamed by a collective group their entire life. And so I believe there's a sense of trust within that community that allows you to facilitate this a lot more than what you would see in a regular societal exchange of something similar. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a lot to say around that. there's, you know, the shared nature of the oppression does create some safety and trust. But I think also within the gay men's community, there's also a lot of culture building around safety in sexual experiences. So there's kind of, not to say that we are, you know, we're doing everything perfectly and all that, but there are some basic methods of consent that are kind of widespread in the gay community, and a certain ability to speak one's desires and to ask for what you want and to set boundaries. I think that's partly just our conditioning as men and the privilege we have as men to, you know, being taught, more so than women, being taught that we are in control of our bodies, that we deserve to get what we want, that we were able to set boundaries when we need to set boundaries. And so when you're in the dynamic of, you know, across gender, a man, especially if it's a male therapist working with a female client, that brings a lot of extra dimensions of power that need to be taken into account. And really, like, for me, there's questions around, to what degree is the client, and this is a question I ask myself all the time, regardless of who I'm working with, but the question is, to what degree does my client have the power to speak their voice? And how do we create the situation and the context where they can move more into that? So I think, again, that's even especially more important when working across gender.
You know, it's funny that you're describing like a highly advanced social exchange, which society right now seemingly is just really starting to grapple with. And by the sounds of it, has been present for quite some time in your community. This idea of setting boundaries in advance and understanding what consent is and having a malleable consent that can change over the course of the interaction is something profoundly important. And, you know, you're seeing this right now kind of being maybe personified by the Me Too movement and people actually taking a lot more responsibility for what goes on in society, is the seemingly inability for people to understand that consent can change and what consent actually is.
Yeah.
And I find that really interesting that you've, I don't know if this was like a trial and error method or if this is something that sort of exists in the community, but, you know, the idea of being able to do sort of sensual touch and providing sexuality in what one could very arguably suggest is like a therapeutic context with psychedelics, to me, that is such a very difficult bridge to cross. But I guess at the end of the day, it really comes down to accessible communication. You know what I mean? Because I imagine there's some people who have a lot of difficulty even saying no. You know what I mean? Because saying no in itself is viewed as wrong in current circumstances, depending on who the individual is. You know, having that ability to say no and have someone stop, or to explore your sexuality, feeling safe about the fact that it can stop at any point in time, I think is very important.
Yeah, I think, you know, this brings us to the kind of the biggest topic of concern around this work, which is the question of consent. And how do we know that a client is consenting to activity or kind of touch? And how do we safeguard against situations where maybe the client doesn't actively say no, but there's an internal no, but they're unable to voice that? And so first off, I'll say that, of course, there's no foolproof method for this. It's always a dance as a facilitator of this work to be really present to that possibility. But having said that, there's a lot we can do as practitioners to really lean into consent culture. And part of that is really training your client about what consent looks like. And in this, right, one of the most helpful resources that I've come across is Dr. Betty Martin's Wheel of Consent, She's based out of Seattle and has been teaching this model for about the last 10, 15 years. And what I like about her model is that she, you know, we tend to have a very legalistic notion of consent, which is kind of because when we have these consensual violations happening in the media, which is how we mostly hear about it, it's in some sort of court battle, police investigation, and then there becomes this big media coverage around how do we prove, you know, how do we prove that the consent was violated, and how do you, if you're the victim, how do you prove that you were, you didn't consent, and it becomes this really narrow discussion about like, did I say yes? Did I say no? What was the text? You know, like it becomes, because that's just the nature of legalities, is you have to kind of have a very clear line. And
yeah, you have to eliminate complexity and make it as streamlined as humanly possible. But yet the unfortunate fact surrounding this is that it's profoundly complicated. People are profoundly complicated. And that again brings you to that barrier of, you know, how can this function outside of the environment that you've created and along for other people? Like, you know, our mutual friend, she's a straight female and she went to you. And I would imagine probably on some level, because of your sexuality, she felt probably comfortable with you in that environment. And, yeah. You know, when she was talking about it, she said that midway through, she just started crying just based on just releasing all this pent up emotion regarding her sexuality. Mm. You know, I think that's something that should be open for anyone to explore. But then it posts totally. That same problem. Like even now with MDMA, you know, with MAPS Canada, and there were all these concerns about practitioners having sex with their patients, not even during, but afterwards. Like it's, yes. I think it's very difficult to create these extremely vulnerable situations with people that, and let's be realistic, sexuality is not something that you can separate from humans. You can't. Yep. It's physically impossible. As much as we try to eliminate sexuality from everyday function, it is ingrained in us completely. Like one could very arguably say is that the only reason any of us are even alive on this planet is to procreate from a raw biological statement. So if you have 3.5 billion years of reproduction instinct built into you, and that is our biological purpose, you can't separate that from any of our emotional behaviors.
Exactly. And so,
you know, you come back into this statement where it's like, okay, if we're trying to truly heal people and allow people to work through their problems, you can't separate these things as much as we want to try, as much as we want to just skirt over one of the biggest contributing motivating factors of humanity and try and just, you know, issue subtle band-aids on the periphery, then we're not really going to get anywhere. And so I just want to ask you, and you know, in whatever capacity you want. So when you're, like you said, that when you're getting into sort of psychedelic with sort of this sexual touch work that you're doing, it doesn't start with psychedelics and sexual touch because obviously, like you had said, you know, you don't want to hit a roadblock right away when someone's in this psychedelic state.
Yep.
So normally you're building trust with someone. I would imagine that you're developing an understanding of consent through pre-circumstances. And then you get to that point where someone, you have that unspoken understanding between the two of you and that psychedelics become involved. And then you start going through this sort of like a sexual touch and massage and allowing people to express themselves and be vulnerable in that environment. Is that?
Yeah. Well, first off is that it's quite different for each person. What constitutes trust for each person will really vary quite a lot. And the experience people bring into, you know, when they show up at my door is widely divergent. Some people have done psychedelics several times. This is kind of not new for them. Other people, they're totally new to any sort of sexual healing, any sort of psychedelic work. So it's hard to generalize. But the main thing being that I think for all of us who are in this space, one of the things I consider foundational is to say that, you know, what is the power of psychedelics? The power of psychedelics is that they kind of remove the kind of what you know, sometimes they call the ego layer, that that layer of us that's filtering, controlling, kind of like censoring. And so we just kind of get this unfiltered, unbiased, or at least more unbiased kind of expression of what's happening internally. And if we don't include desire as something that's valuable to express, if we just value people's ideas or just their beliefs or just their memories or just their dreams or just their, you know, all the other stuff, we're actually missing out on a key component. And the other thing about this that's so important, that's so profound about this work, is that this kind of work with desire is fundamentally about the present moment. It's not some past situation. It's not some future, you know, situation you're wanting to work with. It's about being right here, right now with the desire and noticing, you know, if you're the client, noticing what is your desire. And one of the key things is that clients have desires to be touched or, you know, in some way receiving, to be seen, to be heard, to be held, but they also have desires to touch, to hold, to witness somebody else in their embodied sexuality. So I think, you know, as a practitioner, you have to get clear, first of all, is like, what are you offering? What are your boundaries? As you know, because you have to stay in integrity, and we all have boundaries, so it's, you know, that's fair. But in this case, is like, I always like to say that when I tell clients, it's like, share all your desires, share that, if that's like some hot fantasy that's coming up in your mind right now, like share that. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're gonna act it out, but share it. We're going to celebrate that. We're going to, even if it's something considered shameful or if it's beyond my boundaries, like that's totally fine. Like, let's, you know, for example, I don't include fucking with clients, and that's just my own boundary because, you know, it's part of, yeah, just my own thing. It's a little too intimate for me to be sharing with a client. And this is both sober and in the psychedelic space. But the point is, like, if that's their desire, like, tell me all about it. Let's lean into the visualization of that fantasy. And let's, more fundamentally, is what's the underlying, like, what's that underlying energy of, like, oh, I want to, it's this, you know, whatever it is. It could be a desire to be, you know, penetrated and filled and just feel someone else's energy inside of you and to feel, you know, anyways, that's just an example. But the point being, like, you can still do a lot of work even without necessarily enacting the fantasy.
I think sometimes too is like, you know, like you're saying, it seems that the simple act of just being able to express your sexuality in an environment that you will not be judged, like acting it out is, you know, I'm sure it's relevant on some level for certain circumstances, but just simply the act of being in an environment where you can talk about it and be validated. So out of curiosity, you know, so when you're working with people in what I perceive to be a highly vulnerable state and you both have your boundaries set out, you know, in a way to express this is that taking on other people's energies, you know, taking on other people's shame, taking on other people's negative, because I feel like the vast majority of people, if there's a vessel that they can dump their waste into in a sense of emotional garbage, they will do it subconsciously.
Yep.
And how do you avoid that? You know, like, because to me, it's like there's, you know, you look at psychiatrists and the rates of suicide and depression within psychiatry and you know, psychology, and it's very realistic. People are, as much as they're telling you horrible things that you can be traumatized by their vernacular, there's an exchange of energy that's occurring. You know, you're taking on someone's pain, you're validating it, and you're sort of giving it back to them to some extent. And by doing so, you know, that's, it's a lot of weight to take on. And especially in the sense of that you, to me, what you're doing is you're going to the source of people. Are you going to the very source of who they are as an energetic being, as a sexual being, and you're seeing this vulnerability and you're moving around and working with it. And there's heavy amounts of shame and self-loathing associated with that, much for the reasons that we discussed earlier. But I think that everyone has ideas of shame with their sexuality. You know what I mean? Some more than others, depending on a variety of different circumstances. But how do you navigate that in the sense of...
Well, I'll just back up one step, which is to say that, you know, part of this inheritance of the religious context we work with is the veneration of pain and suffering. Pain and suffering are seen as valuable, transformative. You know, it's good to experience these things because they kind of can heal you and et cetera. And I'm not discounting that at all. But I think what that misses is that pleasure is equally capable of transformation and change. And so I think we have this unconscious tendency, most people, including myself, but especially working with clients, is to think that I have to access something that is really painful, awful, shameful, something that's really uncomfortable in order to heal. And what I like to do is to flip the narrative a bit and say, okay, our intention is, first off, is pleasure. And second is joy. The first thing is pleasure. We focus on pleasure because pleasure in itself, you know, as Betty Martin teaches, is we hit what's called a pleasure ceiling. So we start building up pleasure in the body, and it, you know, this can't go on forever. We hit a ceiling somewhere, and that ceiling could be biological because our body just can't handle more, but oftentimes it's emotional. Something gets raised, something gets triggered, something, a shameful thought comes up that basically takes our attention away from the pleasure, and we you know, we've kind of unconsciously hit our ceiling, and so we come down from that ceiling. And so what I'm trying to get at is that, first of all, is having an intention of pleasure does not mean that we're shying away from the shadow or, you know, the more gritty material that somebody may be carrying. But the point being, the method is not to just like dive into the pain and be like, okay, I'm just going to like bear it all and like make this suffering. It's like, no, like we focus on pleasure because the pleasure is actually kind of intelligent, and it's no longer the brain that's saying, oh, I should do this, or I should work on that, or this memory is the one that's important to work on. Because when we get into pleasure, we're in an embodied state, and then kind of like you could say the unconscious or whatever it is will just naturally bring you that pleasure ceiling, and we will then work with what's happening at that in that moment.
You know, it's actually incredible what you're saying to me right now, because when you talk about the ideas of that, we as a society feel that is to confront this negativity. And I think that stems back from these ideas of like Scylla suits and, you know, self-flagellation, reminiscence of theocracy in these religious backgrounds. And then I think that, you know, takes place in talk therapy where the goal is to find the negativity. But it's really interesting how you're saying that you could just do it the opposite way and go in through the intention of pleasure, and that invariably you will find where the block is.
Exactly. And then, you know, the what's transformative, at least in my opinion, is not to just dive into that negativity or whatever you want to call it, you know, shadow or fear or pain or whatever is happening, but to start to recognize that there is pleasure even in those kinds of cathartic releases. You know, it's kind of like an orgasm, you know, when we cry like intensely, this kind of has this very orgasmic quality to it, although it's, you know, it's a different kind of pleasure perhaps, but it has that quality. And so the question, like for me, again, it's not to say that by focusing on pleasure, we're shying away from those difficult things. It could be an expression of anger. Anger also has this very orgasmic quality when we release it and we just kind of unburden or express that energy. So the point being that we're open to all that happening, but let's also lean into when I say orgasmic, I mean, we're trying to lean into the joy of that. Like, how beautiful that I get to express this grief, this intense expression of my love or my longing or what I lost and, you know, et cetera. Like, you know, and that's not to say that that's always going to happen. You know, of course, people will in that moment are just experiencing what they're experiencing. But the point being we are orienting towards pleasure, not pain for the sake of pain.
Well, and it also seems too, in some sense, is that if you start from the perspective of pleasure, it's a lot easier to reframe the experience in that same manner. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you enter the experience with the anticipation of pleasure. You encounter something that's dark within you. You encounter something that's shameful or full of pain. But yet, you know, it's easy to reframe something in more of a more positive and catharsis way, as opposed to going into it with anticipation of fear.
And there's something really powerful about then, you know, okay, so something has come up. Maybe it's like a body insecurity, or like, you know, I hate this part of my body, or, you know, whatever. It could be anything, as some shame from some previous relationship where you regret something you did or whatever. And the point being, okay, that's come up. And, you know, we kind of give that some space, but also it's like, we're not going to just endlessly process that as if that was the point, you know, learning to let it go. And how do I come back to my body and start to access pleasure again? Not to say that it's necessarily going to be like sexual arousal or anything, but even if it's like, oh my God, I just had this intense expression of grief. How do I take care of my body and express love and gratitude and warmth in an embodied way to myself, having had that experience? So the reason I bring all this up is because for me as a practitioner, it helps to have this framing, because it makes it a lot more sustainable to do this work. Because like you said, we're not just diving into this abyss of endless pain and trauma and, you know, et cetera. Even if that's how they might experience it, that to me is, some people may be okay with doing that, but for me, that's not very helpful. You know, I often use the analogy of like the edge. So we go to the edge, and a lot of times that edge is the edge of pleasure, but it could also be the edge of pain or something shameful or whatever. We can only hang out at the edge for so long. And if we keep pushing the edge and we keep forcing ourselves there, it's like we just kind of actually shut off. And so it's counterproductive. So we go to the edge and then we back off, and we kind of really focus on self-care, pleasure, to kind of integrate that energy into your being. And then, you know, if we're ready, then we can, yeah, go to the edge again and back and forth.
So is the eventual goal to have a climax and a sexual climax in the state of where you're doing it, you're not forcing it, it's occurring in the most natural possible way? And I would imagine probably not a lot of these do end in that capacity, but is that sort of the general idea, is that people can have a full sexual experience inhibited from the baggage that we carry with us? Because I feel like that's, on some level, like my wife and I, we do similar. And that kind of has been my trajectory as well as hers, is to just be inhibited with ourselves. And then once you're inhibited yourself, you can be inhibited with someone else, because, you know, it's like the notion of the broken healer. You know what I mean? Like you're broken yourself, and you're projecting and you're trying to fix everyone else around you as opposed to fixing yourself. Yep. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is that you can't really truly help anyone unless you look into yourself and sort out your own issues.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which
I would say that for someone like me, working with pleasure, there's a real key part of how much time am I giving myself, just as a person in the world who has his own desires and his own pleasures, how much time am I giving myself to explore myself? And that's really important, because if I'm starting to lean on my clients as my source of sexual pleasure or excitement or fulfillment of fantasies, then that becomes very dangerous, because now the dynamic has been inverted. So I would say that anyone who's involved in this kind of work, you have to be really proactive about exploring your own sexuality, your own fantasies, your own desires, because otherwise you'll start projecting that onto clients.
Yeah. So out of curiosity, you know, how did you...
I do want to answer your question around sexual climax, because I think that's an important one. First off, there's no script for these sessions, and it really depends on the narrative or the whatever the client is bringing to work with. Sometimes people, and this is more in the sober state, but, you know, sometimes clients may have challenges around premature ejaculation or just not being able to ejaculate, in which case then that might be a kind of goal around, like, okay, how do we work with cock pleasure? And, you know, if you're ejaculating prematurely, how do we extend that pleasure? How do we learn to move the energy through the body so that it's not just coming out immediately in orgasm? Or vice versa, if a person can't ejaculate, you know, then maybe it's like, yeah, like, we're just going to give you as much cock stimulation as possible and see if we can get to that point together. And that might be a great success or something that the client wants. Having said that, is though, that's not the general intention that I carry into a session with a client. It's only if that's their focus. Really, the focus of this is, like I said, is more about accessing pleasure. And pleasure comes in many forms. And especially working with men, we tend to be really focused on sexual climax. Not all, but often. We're pretty familiar with that experience. We know how to have that experience, and it's kind of a well-worn groove. Not to say that that can't be included in a session, but it's just, like, my invitation to clients is like, okay, what might it be like to experience more full body pleasure that's less goal oriented? You know, one of the analogies that my teachers, like Osho Rajneesh, teaches is, like, instead of the usual going to the top of a high peak and jumping off that peak, which is kind of the traditional sexual narrative for a lot of men, instead it's more like rolling hills and valleys. And that will often be more challenging for people, because it extends pleasure for a long period of time. And there's two ways of hitting your pleasure ceiling. One is to raise the intensity, and sometimes that will hit your peak. And that's essentially what ejaculation is your body is putting in that biological mechanism to say, can't do anymore. We're short-circuiting this process. And the other way is to extend it in terms of length. And a lot of times that can be very challenging to be in an aroused state for longer periods of time without that usual short circuit ending to it.
It almost seems like that the journey is more important than the finish, and that learning how to meander the path and be with yourself in that space is sort of the overall goal of what you're doing to some extent, no?
Yeah. And I would say that there's a profound healing quality or potential for transformation in the letting go of arousal. So we wake up some pleasure. So perhaps it could be accompanied by genital arousal, but not necessarily. And then it's like, okay, we've come to the top of the hill and now we let it go. And there's a lot of oftentimes fear in that, fear around like, I'm losing something. Oh no, like I'm going to lose my, you know, it could be I'm losing my erection, or I'm losing the touch, I'm losing the connection, I'm losing. And it's like, there's like this embodied reaction of like, no, I need to hold on. And so and that will oftentimes bring up some material that someone needs to work with or wants to work with.
So out of curiosity, you know, how did you get to this place? You know, like what you're describing to me is like an incredible amount of knowledge within this and, you know, understanding and this carefully choreographed dance with other people, including yourself, in navigating this situation. And to me, like this is a niche market, let's be realistic. So how did you end up here? Like, you know, what led you to this place? Because this is very fascinating.
Yeah, you know, I grew up completely secular. And then in my early 20s, started realizing I had this urge or this desire to explore spirituality. I explored many traditions, but I kind of ended up mostly focusing on Buddhist meditation. And I was most drawn to the Tibetan Buddhist lineage, which is a tantric lineage of Buddhism. Now, having said that, in the kind of public realm of spirituality and meditation and all that, there's nothing at all sexual happening in those contexts.
Now, is that because of a Western whitewashing, or is that because people just choose not to view that in that context of living?
You know, I don't know, because I've never been to Tibet to like compare. However, my understanding of Tantra in its traditional context is that Tantra has always been considered a very esoteric and like potentially very transformative and potentially dangerous set of teachings. And that's why even from from the beginning, really, as far as I understood, is that Tantra has always been what's called a secret lineage, in that the instructions are not written down. They're not for mass consumption. And Tantra is a tradition that passes down orally from guru to disciple. And this was to maintain an integrity in the teachings, but not, for me, it's not so much about some like imagined purity of my religion, but it's just that this work, especially working with sexuality or working with psychedelics, it cannot be understood just through reading. It's kind of an energetic transfer. That I don't want to say transfer, because it sounds like it's coming from me to them, but it's like,
I know what you mean because of my psychedelic experiences, and I don't know a way to explain that other people would. But I think in a sense is that, you know, when you're dealing with this nonverbal energy between people, it is a transfer. There is an exchange. There is a movement, a flow of energy back and forth. And that's,
I think from a more like traditional psychotherapeutic model, I would say it's kind of like I am modeling a kind of behavior or a certain orientation that then the client can actually, it's different than just reading or thinking about it, because you're actually seeing it embodied in front of you, and it actually gives you some alternative narrative or some alternative model to reorient oneself.
Creating archetypes for emulation to some extent.
Yeah, I don't know if archetype is the right word. Probably more like the role modeling behaviors around just like the simple things of like accepting without judgment, having compassion for those difficult parts, which I think is happening in any psychotherapeutic context. But it's just in this context, it's because we're including sexuality on the table, it's even more of an embodied experience. And it's not something that can be communicated with words. It's something that is just held. So anyways, all that to say that, you know, Tantra, from my understanding, has always been edgy. And it's not for everybody. And that's kind of what attracted me to it, even though, you know, ostensibly I was just doing meditation, but at least reading the philosophy of it, the philosophy of it is quite different from most other Eastern religions, even in that it's really, you know, oftentimes it's called non-dual. But the point being that in Tantra, we don't differentiate between the good and the bad, so to speak, in terms of any state of consciousness that we experience, whether it's pleasure or pain, or whether it's, you know, good or evil, or, you know, whatever labels we choose to put on our thoughts, is like we really embrace every state of consciousness as an expression of enlightenment. And there's no state of consciousness that's to be rejected or to be disowned. So this, of course, is kind of the basis then for, you know, using sexuality as a vehicle or as a platform for exploring one's own, you know, source energy or connection to source. So having said that, is then I left that kind of tantric meditation setting, and then I came back to Vancouver, and I you know, wanted to. I had spent 2 years in a monastery where it was a very small community, and it was like, obviously there was no sex happening. And so then I came to Vancouver and I started, you know, having lots of different sexual encounters. And I suddenly realized there has to be a way to bridge these two worlds, because I just spent 2 years in kind of deep meditation, doing many hours of meditation a day, and then suddenly experiencing the power of this sexual energy. And so that's how I met my teacher, you could say, who's also now my partner. Sequoia was teaching Men in Touch workshops. So I signed up for one of these workshops, and it's essentially it's a group workshop where, you know, everybody's sober, but we have this common intention of exploring pleasure in the body, learning how to move pleasure through the body, really about integrated sexuality. And so that just really suddenly provided the link to be like, oh, so this is how this meditative tantric teachings come together with my energy. And so from there, I started to offer, you know, the thing about this world is that there's no training, there's no certification, there's no governing body, which is partly what I love about it. And it's, as Sequoia said, the best way to learn is to just put yourself out there and learn as you go, learn through experience. And so, you know, it's been about, I think I started offering in 2016, maybe 2015. Yeah, I think it was 2016. And so it just kind of never looked back. And then, you know, the psychedelic portion of it was something that just came about because I was personally exploring psychedelics. And it was kind of like, you know, like I said, psychedelics, they kind of remove our inhibitions or judgments for a while. And so it's just this beautiful way to access erotic energy that can be hidden or covered in shame. And so the healing potential of that is just really obviously huge. So I started offering that about 4 years ago.
So out of curiosity, you know, we were touching on this before, you know, and like I was at a microdose conference for psychedelics in Miami, and I was talking to some people there about MDMA and couples therapy and utilizing sexuality when they're in it. You know, do you think that in the current state that society is functioning in, that this is something that can actually be done for people? You know, I think having couples would probably be a lot better than having an individual facilitator working on people. Yeah. Because like you said, like I don't think that you could have large groups of people doing this without people having infractions of control and, you know, their own sexuality trickling through. You know, like I think it creates an incredible amount of self-control and self-awareness and self-understanding to be facilitating this. And, you know, and I think it's profoundly important that people are able to explore their sexuality and be vulnerable with themselves. and so that they can have healthy sexual relationships with other people and with their partners and everything. So on, like, you know, as a continuation of the question, do you think it's even possible that this can be something that is be accepted in a mainstream capacity?
Given the current context, right. No.
No.
Where we'll be in 20, 30, 50 years? It's really hard to say, but you know, I also think that it's not an entirely modern phenomenon, because like I said, you know, Tantra has always operated as a secret fringe experience that is, it's just outside of the margins. It's always existed outside of the margins. There's just no way you can institutionalize or regulate this kind of work. Now, having said that, I think we can do some basics. You know, I think there's like best practices. There's, you know, a certain ethical standard that we can live by. But to turn it into some sort of organization or some sort of program that you would like offer like to the masses. And, you know, in terms of methods, like what would you do? I think it's just so dependent on each individual practitioner, you know, regarding, like I said, my own individual boundaries and what, you know, each person has their own unique gift. And so it's kind of like, how do you institutionalize that? And I think in general, it's just like we see with Me Too, there's just a lot of generational ancestral trauma out there. And there's a lot of healing work that I think needs to be done before we would get to a point where that would be kind of
That's actually a very, very
accepted.
I completely agree with that, is that, you know, a foundation has to be created before we can explore our sexuality. And it's not there right now at all.
Which is why I really love Betty Martin's Wheel of Consent, because it really does provide a kind of language that's much more subtle and nuanced understanding of consent than what I previously was describing as the kind of more legalistic ideas. You know, there's some tough conversations we have to have around consent. And ultimately, what the place that we want to move towards, even though not everybody's there, is ultimately we have to get people to take responsibility for their energy. And if you know, sometimes the energy is really aggressive, dominant, pushy, and that's one side of it. But there's also the other side of it is that sometimes the energy is like, I'm a doormat. I identify as a victim. Things happen to me. I don't do them myself. And this is equally problematic like, it's kind of like, I think it's kind of these two feed on each other, let's just say. And we can't just, you know, I think a lot of times the attention is on the men need to change their behavior because they're usually the aggressors, which I agree with. But again, that's only half of the picture. And we have to be doing the other half of it is really working with people who identify as voiceless or powerless or victims to really start to empower them to speak and advocate for themselves and start to take responsibility for the experiences that they are also co-creating in their touch lives.
And it almost seems like it has to be an entire reevaluation of our society and how we view sexuality, how we view, you know, specific genders and what role that gender plays in sexual interactions. And the idea of consent being boiled down to a simple yes or no in circumstance is not adequate. And again, too, you're right. It takes both sides to create a condition or environment in which consent can be evolving constantly and be appropriately utilized. And it's funny too, you know, with the Me Too movement, like everything is sort of like a pendulum, right? And we went from a place where, you know, we were shaming victims, and then all of a sudden it swings back and it's this hyper personification of male perpetrators, which needed to happen. But it, but then unfortunately that causes this backlash of people saying, well, now if there's no real definition of consent, how do my, does my son, does this operate in this environment? And I'm hoping that it swings back and there's this commonality that's found between the ideas of what consent is, and that people can establish sort of a foundation for understanding sexuality and being more able to move within it, if that's a statement that seems reasonable.
Yeah. And I think there also, A, is just we need to really be talking about this a lot more. I think, you know, obviously talking can help to a degree. And having these conversations around gender, you know, between genders, you know, I think one of the things a lot of, you know, straight men don't realize is that, you know, women are carrying a lot of trauma in their bodies, even if they're so-called fine or untraumatized. But it's like you assume, and you know, it's the same, I assume, with gay men, you know, there is like, that is, again, like I said, that's the nature of the oppression is, you know, and with women, it's demonizing their sexuality. Their genitals are considered dirty or shameful, or, you know, it's, that's just something that is so prevalent in our society. And all the narratives women have around, you know, through pornography, around how they should behave sexually and what's expected of them, et cetera. This is all part of the field that we're working with. And so, you know, if I was just a regular straight guy who's like, whatever, 25 years old and starting to have sex with women, and I'm like, oh, she just wants to be powerless and kind of like, you know, just, you know, enact this porn fantasy, and that's just really what she wants. Like, there has to be a level of self interrogation around that and be like, okay, like, what does it mean for someone to find their voice? And how do I know that that's happening?
Well, and I think too, part of the problem is that, you know, like, I feel like we went to a place, and it's hard to basically stereotype all of North America, where teaching sexual education, you know, went further and further and further. And it seems like we have this regression. I'm not saying that we've gone back to just, you know, abstinence, but it seems that, you know, kids and teenagers need information. And if we're not giving it to them in a responsible way, they're going to look outwards for it. And pornography now has seemingly taken an entirely new tone to it. One of violence and control and this weird aggression that's within it. And I find that, you know, unless we're taking control of sexuality and teaching it in a responsible and healthy way to our children, that something else is going to fill the void. And like you said too, you know, we have people who are patterning their behavior from what one might perceive as toxic pornographic innuendo. And it's kind of alarming. But again, too, right?
Yeah.
It's a highly, highly complicated subject matter that, you know, it's going to take a lot more than just a couple avenues of change. It's going to require a societal change in itself, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is part of a larger conversation around this new
it
era.
It really is. I know, we're meandering
social
off.
Media, internet.
ZG, one thing I do want to ask you, being vulnerable, either individually or in a relationship is challenging. Obviously psychedelics can kind of help kind of bridge that gap and get people over the hump, as it were. How is it, or what is it you would recommend for, say, some of our listeners out there who may be wanting to delve into some of the things that you're talking about, but may not necessarily be located where you are? How would they kind of dip their toes in the water and maybe be vulnerable with each other and open themselves up to be a little more receptive, maybe to each other, both emotionally, physically, and sexually?
Yeah, good question. Well, as I've spoken a few times, I think Dr. Betty Martin's work around consent is, for me, even as somebody who has been in this field for a long time, it's really transformational. It really provides a different context for understanding how we interact with other people. So she has a book out. It's called The Art of Giving and Receiving, or The Art of Receiving and Giving. And it's the most subtle, nuanced, but also direct and clear presentation I've ever encountered. And the beautiful thing about it is that it's not really just limited to touch, because every interaction we have between two people, there's always a giving and a receiving. There's always an exchange of energy happening. And even outside of the sexual consent world, is there's all sorts of conflicts and workplace things that, you know, take place. And fundamentally, most of those conflicts come back down to somebody felt like a boundary was violated. And so there was some sort of consent thing that never got discussed, or a feeling never got expressed, or, you know, whatever. So the point being, I find her work endlessly fascinating and very applicable to many contexts. The other thing I would say is that, you know, it's definitely like edgier, but, you know, working with a practitioner one-on-one, like I said, in a sober state first, is a great way to start.
Now, for some of those who may be a little more less into the space, how would they find an appropriate practitioner that is both skilled and reputable?
Yeah, like I said, this is an unregulated field. And so you're going to, there's a level of risk involved in that. You really don't know. You don't know what you're going to get. But having said that, is that, you know, you can get a lot from reading somebody's website or looking at their profile. Again, like, I don't know all the individual websites because, you know, there might be many websites I'm not aware of. But generally speaking, if you search certain keywords in your Google, and, you know, like I my URL is Gay Massage Vancouver because I know that that's what most people will search. But, you know, whatever context you're in, just searching around, whether it's searching for tantra, sexual healing, sometimes the word sacred intimacy is a word that's used. So that might, you know, ding something.
Yeah, I guess that kind of helps. That's more so what I was wondering is, like, what are some of the industry terms or words that would help somebody?
Well, and keep in mind too, is that what you're offering is very, 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 very different than what we perceive as an adult massage parlor, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's, and that's the thing where it's like, well, how do I find something like this? And it's like, I don't even know how you would, because what you offer is a niche, and it's very, 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 I'm not gonna say obscure, but, you know, it's sort of, unfortunately, because of the fact that, you know, one could arguably suggest that given the amplitude of what you're doing, that it is sex work, right? I mean, it's a safe statement.
Yep.
But you're doing it in the context of therapy and healing touch, which creates an entirely new ambience for it. And so because the law is relatively indiscriminate on what people are doing within it, as long as, you know, once you start operating underneath it, then it's very, very indiscriminate. And so, and that's sort of the difficult part about this is I don't even, you know, it's...
Some other key words that are good to search. One is, you know, there are some programs out there. California is the only jurisdiction that's created some sort of institutional recognition. And it's created this designation of a sexological body worker. Hmm. So that's something you could search. Even if you're outside of California, some people have trained in California and then go to their home city, and they'll still advertise as a sexological body worker, but that designation doesn't have any institutional meaning outside of California.
Yeah, there's not a regulatory body and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you also have somatic sex educators is sometimes a phrase that's used. So the idea being that they're not just sex educators, they're like somatic sex educators, means that they're teaching you through the body. And yeah, so those would be the main search words I would use. And then in terms of workshops, I would say the best organization that's kind of most widely accessible in the North America is the Body Electric. And they host men's only, women's only, and all gender retreats. And I've done several of their retreats, and I find the quality of their work to be quite high. Very much in the same vein of kind of more working with the shamanistic, the more esoteric dimension of sexuality.
I think you're answering the question more that I was sort of looking for the answer, where it's like, you know, organizational structure that deals with this subject matter that people can go and get their feet in if they're curious, as opposed to, you know, Google searching erotic massage, which probably isn't going to take you.
Because I think, unfortunately, like a lot of people already with any sort of sexual hangups are going to be hesitant to even know how or where to look. So I think this is incredibly helpful that you're able to kind of navigate and somewhat provide some guidance for our listeners.
Well, and even people having the resources to learn how to be vulnerable with their partner and then exploring sexuality in a more healthy way with someone who they trust, and both of them learning how to be vulnerable with one another, I think is really important.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's because at the end of the day, that's what we're doing, right? Is we're trying to learn how to be vulnerable with ourselves, to be vulnerable with someone else. And I think that that's a pretty reasonable methodology. Well, DG, I got to admit, and I want to say that, like, I really enjoyed this conversation. And, you know, I think it's very important that people understand how sexually repressed we are as a society. And, you know, and the reasons why, and the ideas of sexual vulnerability and the traumas that we store inside ourselves. So I honestly really appreciated this conversation, the interview. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. And
without it being too on the nose there, ZG, do you have any pluggables you'd like to plug for our audience?
A good book to explore is called Urban Tantra, although I forget the author's name, but it's a nice way to start with just kind of different self-pleasure and couples pleasure practices that are outside of the box of, you know, traditional sex. Yeah. So yeah, there are resources out there, and it's not impossible. In terms of plugs, I mean, I would just say, you know, the main thing I do is Men in Touch, but we're mostly local in Vancouver here, so it's not super applicable to most of your audience, but yeah, I would say overall,
we actually have a lot of people. In Victoria.
We do have a number of people in Victoria and Vancouver. So,
okay, cool. But I would say that one thing I want to leave your audience with is, you know, sex. And when I use the word sex, I don't mean just the act of sex, but sexual energy is profound. It's a celebration of who we are. It's a celebration of our innermost divine self. It's part of this beautiful inheritance that we have received from our ancestors, you know, into the animals and beyond that. It's like, it's this beautiful gift that we've received, and it's kind of like up to us to unwrap that gift. And so, you know, just basically exhorting people to explore, to honor your sexuality, your desires, and to trust that when done with integrity, that it can be profoundly empowering, healing, and beautiful.
No, well said. Very well said.
I think that's a wonderful note to end on.
Yeah, so do I.
All right. Well, thanks again, ZG. We really appreciate you being on the episode today.
Yeah, thank you to both of you for hosting. It's been great to be here.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. And yeah, I'll thank you again and continue doing what you're doing.